Ask Dr. Dawn is produced by Jiva Media at the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn, KUSP and the Monterey Bay Area's own interactive call-in medical program. I hope you'll stay tuned for an hour of medical dialogue and maybe even join in with a question. Before that, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. Coming soon to a TV screen near you, a new weight loss drug. Fabulous weight loss results. And guess what? It's based on marijuana. How about that? Well, it turns out that just like the human brain has opiate receptors, it has cannabinoid receptors. And as people, I'm sure no one has experienced this personally, but it is said that users of marijuana sometimes experience an increase in appetite, particularly as craving for sweets and starchy foods. And in fact, this is probably due to a cannabinoid 1 receptor in the brain. So industrious scientists working for the pharmaceutical corporations have been playing around with this for a few years, and they've come up with a drug. The drug, Rimonabant. It's a selective cannabinoid 1 receptor blocker. And I'm quoting here a Journal of the American Medical Association article from a couple of months ago. It's February 15th, 2006, a randomized double-blind placebo-controlled study of about 3,000 people who were overweight or obese. These studies was done at 64 different places in the United States and 8 Canadian research centers over a 3-year period of time. And this was a single-blind placebo plus diet run-in period, and then the patients were assigned to receive either placebo, 5 milligrams of Rimonabant, they're going to have to work on that name, but I'm sure the marketing people are up to it, or 20 milligrams for a year. Then they looked at weight loss. Basically, what they found was that people who were on the 5 milligram dose had no significant weight loss compared to placebo, but people on the 20 milligram dose had fairly significant weight loss, about 15 pounds, and it was maintained. They also lost around the waist. Their triglycerides improved. Their good cholesterol improved. And then halfway through the study, at the end of year one, they switched people over to placebo, and those on the 20 milligram group who were switched to placebo gained the weight back. So this is really great from a marketing standpoint, because not only do we have a drug that helps you lose weight, we have a drug that is going to need to be continued to be taken. Now, nicely, unlike most other weight loss drugs, this doesn't seem to affect the heart or the cardiovascular system. It's not a stimulant, after all, and it works by blocking the cannabinoid receptor. Now, it does it in the brain and in the fat tissue. And something very interesting about when you block cannabinoid 1 receptors in the fat tissue is you get a decrease in a hormone called adiponectin, which is a hormone that's released by fat cells. Remember, up until a few years ago, we thought of fat as a passive storage tissue, but it turns out that fat is a hormone-producing organ. It produces about 11 different hormones, most of them which make you eat. It sort of acts to perpetuate itself. Anyway, in this study, the good thing about this new drug is its safety profile, which was excellent. No signs of cardiovascular issues, no increase in blood pressure, no problems with people who are smokers. It improved people's insulin resistance, so it didn't have any adverse side effects in that department. And, safety-wise, this was a great success. I love that this is essentially an anti-marijuana drug in the sense that it's blocking the marijuana receptor. I also love that it's acting on this receptor system and is extremely safe, because I think that in general, when you have a drug that's coming off of an herbal source, you're looking at something that the body has evolved to handle. So I'm always pleased. And I love the irony here. On the subject of marijuana, coming up in a week or two, we're going to have an interview with a local Santa Cruz doctor who's opening up a medical marijuana clinic, charting a brave new world and taking some considerable personal risk, I think, given the climate. We'll be talking with Dr. Helen Nunberg sometime in the next few weeks, and I will give you more information and promote that show when I have a better idea about exactly when we'll be scheduling it. Let's take just a moment and say thank you to our sponsors. Ask Dr. Dawn is made possible by a grant from Dominican Family Birthing Center, providing comprehensive lactation services, newborn hearing assessment, and parent support. Dominican Hospital, for comprehensive maternity services, 462-7685, online at DominicanHospital.org. Well, while we're on the subject of obesity control, of course, the big hot thing right now is obesity surgery, and let's staple the stomach. And oddly enough, there is a hormone that the stomach makes when it's hungry called ghrelin, G-H-R-E. And ghrelin, if you staple off the lower half of the stomach, which is what's done in most stomach stapling procedures, is reduced significantly, as is hunger. In fact, if you talk to people who've had stomach surgery or gastric bypass surgery, one of the things they'll tell you is they just don't feel very hungry. And if you check their blood levels for ghrelin, in fact, those levels are very, very low. So we are having an effect with that surgery that was beyond the intention of just gastric bypass. We're actually affecting things hormonally. What are the long-term effects of suppressing ghrelin release in the stomach? Funny you should ask. We haven't the faintest idea. Now, another unintended consequence of gastric surgery, just out in the American Academy newsletter of Family Practice, orthostatic intolerance. In other words, having problems with getting dizzy when you stand up. This seems to be fairly significant. It's not just related to weight loss. These are people who had the surgery, lost weight, and then developed a medical condition where their nervous system doesn't respond properly to posture change. So they'll be sitting down, and then they'll stand up, and they'll get lightheaded. We've all had that experience after being in bed for a few days with the flu. It's not terribly pleasant, and sometimes it can actually lead to actually passing out. In this case, this was only a study that's anecdotal. It was epidemiologic. But they basically, it's a report, the first of several case reports I think we can expect about this condition. It's not clear how long it lasts or if it's a permanent condition. It's looking permanent. All of these people were more than a year out from their surgery and had already lost their weight. So, you know, we live and learn with science, and being the first on your block with a new surgery means you might be the first on your block with a new complication. The bottom line, be sure you really need the surgery. Some of the people who have gastric bypass surgery need it to avoid the life-threatening consequences of their obesity. For them, they are gaining benefit and losing risk. Everything needs to be considered in the context of the individual. And we're going to go now to Elizabeth in Carmel. Hello, Elizabeth.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a question. I listen to your program every week, and I've never heard anything like this before. I have clenching toes, and for the last three years, I've noticed that it's chronic. I hold my toes in a clenching position, like you would clench your fist.
Yes.
And I've developed something of a tremor in my right leg, and it's, you know, even when I'm relaxed, I have a consciously relaxed. I can relax, but it's not involuntary. But it's driving me a little crazy, and I've actually been to a neurologist.
Good, I was going to ask that.
Right, I have, and I had an MRI of the brain and spine, and it was fine. I had a nerve test on my leg, and he said it was great. My nervous impulses are fine, no problem.
Mm-hmm.
I went to one neurologist who was a surgeon. The first thing he said was, "Well, it looks like Parkinson's," and he hadn't really examined me except just to, you know, do the basic stuff.
He must have been cluing in on your tremor, would be my guess,
yes,
to have said that.
I have no problem with my hands.
Some of us, I do it myself, is I'll sort of think out loud, which is a bad idea because the patient gloms onto every word
you
say.
Right, and it was really nerve-wracking. But then I went to another neurologist who said, that's ridiculous, you don't have Parkinson's.
No, I don't think so.
I heard that I was really, because of my weight, because I'm very thin, that it might have something to do with that.
Have you had your electrolytes checked? Are they all in order? Sodium, potassium, calcium, magnesium?
You know, I thought maybe, you know, intuitively that might be it. So I take and eat bananas, and I take potassium, and I take, every day I take magnesium.
But have you checked magnesium levels?
No.
Do that. Make sure this has got, two possibilities. One of which is it's some sort of, you've done the right thing. You've checked out the bad physiological brain tumor, spinal cord lesion. You've done that. It's ruled out great in the sense that you don't have anything here that looks likely to kill you. We know most of those. What you do have is something kind of mysterious and non-life threatening, but life quality threatening.
Mm-hmm.
And you kind of run up to a dead end where with the neurology, I would check electrolytes just because your nerves sound like they've got a high threshold or a low threshold for clenching.
Mm-hmm.
So something's driving that.
Mm-hmm.
Could be brain cells directing it subconsciously or subliminally. So that would be the nervous tic branch of my thinking. And the other possibility is that the nerve itself is more likely to fire, and that could be because of the internal or external electrolyte environment. So that's where magnesium particularly, but all of the trace ions that are important to nerve functioning, I would try to supplement into the middle zone, basically, of the range of normal, if they're not already there. So that would be one potentially fruitful line of inquiry.
Is that just going to a doctor's office? And I mean, how do they do electrolytes?
It's a blood test.
Oh, it's just a blood test.
Just a simple blood test. And normally we don't check magnesium levels routinely, but you'd be one. I would definitely look at magnesium and phosphorus, which you just have to ask for. They're not expensive. They're probably $20 each kind of tests. And you just want to try to supplement yourself into the middle range on all of them and see if that makes a difference.
What if there is no problem there?
If there is no problem there, then I'd say that's a dry hole, and you go on to the next thought, which is hypnosis or acupuncture or body work or some sort of alternative thing, postulating that even though you don't think you're doing it on purpose, some part of your brain is doing this on purpose and trying to turn that off.
Mm-hmm.
It could be a displacement activity. I'm always asking my husband to stop tapping his foot. He doesn't know he's tapping his foot until I ask him to stop. A lot of people have those. This is a little odd, but it could be one of those.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so I would shoot in that direction.
Great. Well, thank you very much.
And thank you for the call.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Those numbers to call with your question, 476-2800, 1-800-655-5877. We're going now to Beth in Felton. Beth, hello.
Hi, Dr. Dawn. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you.
I am calling regarding custom vitamin testing. So basically, you send a urine sample to this company through the mail, and they send you, you know, specifically what your cocktail of vitamins should be. And I tried to do some research online about this, and I wasn't able to find anything except information about the company that does it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was suggested to me by my acupuncturist, and I'm just wondering, because I'd never heard of it, that you might have some information or feedback.
I do, actually. Let's start with saying that I do not agree with the joke I'm about to tell you, but it is a common medical joke, and there is some truth to it. And that is to say that the value of taking vitamins is that it makes for expensive urine.
Oh, yeah.
And this means essentially that of the water-soluble vitamins that pass through the system, the kidney is very good at removing them from the circulation.
Mm-hmm.
So if you take vitamin C or vitamin B, you have to keep taking it, particularly C.
Right.
And one of the problems with taking vitamin C just when you've got a cold, in fact, is that your system will lose vitamin C a lot once you've been taking it, let's say at high doses for a week, mm-hmm. you'll actually pee out almost all the vitamin C. So when you revert back to a non-supplemented diet, your blood levels of vitamin C will dip a lot mm-hmm. for a couple of days until the kidney goes, oh, okay, I don't have excess anymore, so I guess I have to go back to my previous mode of pulling vitamin C out of the bloodstream. Mm-hmm. So the body is designed to remove a lot of these things quickly, and mm-hmm. so megadosing is problematic, and tapering your megadoses is generally a good idea, just in terms of the physiology, not because somebody's done some kind of scientific study, but just if you understand how the mechanism works, you can come up with advice that would work with the mechanism.
Right.
Now, as far as testing the urine, that's going to tell you relative levels of nutrients. It's going to be very sensitive to what you're taking in terms of supplements.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very circular logic. I mean, the idea of putting supplements into your mouth so that you normalize these levels in your urine, or maybe they're trying to make sure that you're excreting all of these things at the same threshold. I don't think there's any physiologic basis for that. It does sound to me a little pseudoscientific, and anyone who's got something alternative to sell or something that's a little out there on the edge to sell, on their website, as far as I'm concerned, should have links, either links to published articles or a reference bibliography of peer-reviewed published articles that support what they're trying to say.
Mm-hmm.
I work a lot with an institution called the Institute for Functional Medicine,
uh-huh.
and they do it right, essentially. That's why I like them. You can go online and look them up. But effectively, when you make a statement that's outside of normal medicine, you have to back it up, okay?
Right.
There are rules of evidence here.
Mm-hmm.
And if you just are selling something on a slick-looking website that's a service, you know, you can buy dog walking services too, but you're probably better off walking your own dog.
Right.
And this doesn't sound very legitimate to me.
Okay.
I would certainly be willing to revise my opinion if someone, you know, from the company shows up with good evidence that's acceptable. But the fact that they aren't putting it out there makes me suspicious.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times in medicine, there's a don't just stand there, do something
mm-hmm.
attitude. And this is just as strong in the alternative world, in the chiropractic world, in the acupuncture world. And you have to decide, you know, what you're going to believe.
Right.
If you're going to accept anecdotal evidence, on what basis are you going to accept it? If you don't want anecdotal evidence, you want scientific evidence, that's going to eliminate certain things that can't be studied that way, like acupuncture is hard to do placebo acupuncture. But I think this is probably a waste of your money.
Mm-hmm.
A better way is to target the particular systems that you're interested in. So you try to work backwards. What is sick?
Mm-hmm.
And if something is sick, what would be the physiologic basis of that sickness that I might be able to affect with supplements?
Mm-hmm.
So a good nutritionist mm-hmm. can help you with that. There are lots of what's called orthomolecular people out there. And while orthomolecular has a shady reputation,
uh-huh.
I think it's undeserved. I think there's a lot of good science-based medicine that's getting ignored because it's in the orthomolecular world.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're trying to fix your molecules, that's what orthomolecular means. Straighten out those molecules.
So Institute for Functional Medicine might have something about orthomolecular on...
Well, I don't know if they've got something about that per se on their sites, but they certainly have a really excellent set of books that I do book reviews occasionally, and some of the books that come out are great, and some of them are garbage, and they all look the same. You know, they've got the cover with the guy, and you don't know.
Yeah.
Their stuff is generally good, and you have to decide what you're chasing here.
Right.
If you're chasing wellness, then I think that would be a really sensible place to start.
Okay. Do you have time for another quickie?
Real quick follow-up question, sure.
It may not be that quick then.
Okay.
I'll pass.
All right, love.
Okay, thanks.
Well, call back next week.
Okay.
All right,
thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Let's go now to Bruce in Seaside. Hello, Bruce. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
I have a quick question about, actually, it's a different kind of problem. The doctor wants me to replace hormones, and I'm not sure that I need to because I don't have any of the symptoms.
Are you on a speakerphone?
No, but I was... being next to the radio.
Okay. That's much better. You sounded very otherworldly there, like you were speaking from the nave of the cathedral. Now you sound more down to earth.
that's how I feel.
Okay, so what's the issue again?
Thyroid TSH, thyroid hormone.
Right.
Blood test I got was listed 9.60H.
Mm-hmm.
I'm 56 years old, and the reference range for the thyroid is 0.34 to 5.6,
mm-hmm.
and I got a reading of 9.6.
Do you have a free T4 level as well? Or just the TSH?
I just have the TSH.
Okay, write this down. You need a free T4, capital T, and that's important because...
And it's a free T, F-R-E-E.
Mm-hmm, yeah, and what that means is thyroid hormone, T4, this is a pro-hormone. Your body tissues uh-huh. convert it to the active form. So your thyroid gland releases T4,
uh-huh.
and then your body tissues convert it to T3. Your conversion we're going to assume for the moment that your conversion is okay, and we're going to say that your T4 level, that your free T4 level, because depending on how much protein you've got circulating in your blood, you may have a lot of T4, but none of it's free. That isn't going to be active or counted. So you want to see if your free T4 level is also in the middle of the reference range. That's important. If your free T4 level is actually low, then you really do have thyroid disease. Another good trick, so I'm assuming you feel fine, and that's part of the problem. Another good trick is to check your body temperature in the morning before you get up or drink any coffee.
Mm-hmm.
All right. If you have a body temperature of like 96.5 in the morning before you get out of bed, that would also tend to validate, this is real. One of the reasons you don't want to have low thyroid is that it increases your tendency towards diabetes and it raises your bad cholesterol.
Mm-hmm.
So a person...
Cholesterol levels are fine.
Okay, good.
Diabetes and sugar levels are fine.
Good. So you got a healthy guy with a lab abnormality
mm-hmm.
who feels fine and is going, why do I need to fix myself?
The low temperature. Actually,
mm-hmm.
that's interesting because about 20 years ago, I went through a one-month period where I took temperature every day in the morning, and my temperature was consistently 1 degree low, 97.6.
Well, what if it's now 96.5? You know, that
mm-hmm.
do that again. I don't think you have to do it for a whole month. A week, an average, the number will probably be sufficient. But that would see that as a secondary validation that you have hormone deficiency. Now, if you feel fine,
mm-hmm.
and your energy levels are good, you're not diabetic or pre-diabetic, and your cholesterol's fine, I don't think there's any reason to supplement. I think there's a reason to monitor. Okay, you may have an autoimmune thyroid condition, or this could just be a fluke. The other thing I want to mention is that if a person gets a viral infection, sometimes their thyroid levels will drop. Their thyroid function will go out for a month. And during that time, their TSH levels will rise. And then as the thyroid recovers from the viral infection, it goes back to normal. And I can't tell you how many people there are out there who are on thyroid hormone because they had a drop in their TSH that was temporary. And the doctor put them on the hormone, and the people have been on hormone for the last 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And needlessly, because their thyroid actually is functional. And there's a lot of that. We don't want you to fall into that trap. So since you feel fine, which is the case usually in this viral thyroid issue, by the way, is that the people feel fine because they haven't had a low thyroid really for long enough to affect them, and it recovers before they ever get symptoms. True hypothyroidism, you sleep all the time, your skin texture gets kind of gummy, and your hair gets thin and fine, you have constipation, your energy level's down, you have these other blood abnormalities. Now, this is a situation where you have to bite the bullet and take the supplements.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Okay. Well, that was very interesting because what my doctor said, he did not have enough time to talk to mention what you had mentioned. He just said, you take these hormones and...
You're fixed up. Bruce, we have a system, due respect to your doctor, because I have sometimes to be, I'm totally torn I have all my financial incentives to do exactly that, to take, 5 minutes, here's the problem, here's the pill, go away. And That is what I'm paid to do, okay? Uh-huh. Seriously, that is the setup. Now, ethically, what you want to do is sit down, have a discussion, make sure the person understands the physiology, talk about where they are in terms of how they're feeling, individualize the medicine. That's the ethical thing to do and the satisfying thing to do. And if I did that on every single patient, I'd go broke. But part of the reason you're listening to me right now on the air is because 12 years ago, I was going nuts. I was guilty. I felt like I was neglecting my mission. I was barely scraping by financially. Not that it's gotten much better, but that's another conversation. But the bottom line was, I started doing radio because I wanted people to have that information, and this was a way that I could get it off my chest and make it as widely available as I could and fulfill that part of my mission as a doctor, because I wasn't managing to do that as well as I liked in the office. And, you know, I try, and certainly it's gotten easier over the years, but still there's this huge tension between what we're paid to do and what we should be doing. And I don't know how to solve it. It's deep. It's a deep systemic issue. In France, for example, they overproduce doctors. The ratio of doctors to patients, there's about 300% more doctors in France than there are here. And so a typical French doctor sees 10 or 12 patients in a day. A typical American primary care doctor sees double or maybe triple that amount. If they're financially successful, they're seeing 30 patients a day. If they're barely getting by, they're seeing 22 or 24, plus doing all the paperwork. If you do the math, what it really boils down to is you don't have time to practice good medicine if you want to stay in business. Talk about a catch-22. In France, the doctors do spend a lot more time. They also make a lot less money. They also start training in college. They basically go to medical school right out of high school, which is why France can overproduce doctors and export them all over the planet. And part of the reason that Doctors Without Borders is everywhere is that France produces a surplus of doctors. Not that that's, I'm not criticizing that, but I'm just kind of saying there's a different economic vibe going on where things work differently.
Well, we certainly appreciate your efforts here, and you're making me feel much better.
Okay, so you're going to monitor your thyroid, and you're going to see how you feel, and you're going to make sure you're maybe get a TSH every couple of months for a while.
Mm-hmm. And I won't have a blood test until after I've been free of any viral disease for a month.
There you go. Sounds like a plan.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, and the name of the program is Ask Dr. Dawn. Ask Dr. Dawn is made possible by a grant from John F. Kennedy University's Graduate School of Professional Psychology in Campbell, offering a master's degree in counseling psychology designed for busy adults. Information at 800-868-2359. So let's go now to John in Monterey. Hello, John. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm calling about my wife. I'll give you a little bit of a history. She had chronic back pain for a number of years. And eventually she was on methadone, and then they put a morphine pump in. And shortly after that, she had always had a little constipation, I suppose, from the methadone.
I'm sorry, what is the basis of your wife's pain, though? Where's it coming
back
from?
Back pain.
Back pain, okay.
And it got, the constipation got worse and worse, and eventually... I mean, she kept going back to the doctors about the constipation, and little or nothing was done. And then finally it came to a head where she had to have her colon removed.
And wait a minute. You're telling me that she has constipation as a consequence of the morphine pump, and then they remove her colon to fix her constipation? Did
well,
she have...
She got so plugged up that her colon actually died.
Okay, so she developed, like, gangrene of the colon?
Well, they didn't say that.
Did she have diverticulitis? Did she have an infection in her colon?
No, they didn't say that.
All right, well, go ahead. I'm a little confused, but I'll try to keep working with you here.
Okay. Well, like I say, the pain got so bad, and we ended up going to the emergency room, and they had to remove her colon. Because it was so plugged, I guess, from the constipation.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying that was a result of the morphine pump, but it happened within a few months after the morphine pump was put in, and she was still on the methadone.
Yes, okay.
But But anyway, she was very constipated. What I'm getting at is, after all of this, her eyesight started getting worse and worse. And recently I saw something on the news about vitamin A absorption.
Right.
And I started thinking, well, maybe this is a possible consequence of the colon being removed.
I don't think so. Most vitamins are absorbed in the small intestine, and the only thing your colon really absorbs is drugs, toxins, and water. But for vitamins, there's active absorption, and vitamin A in particular is absorbed both as a water-soluble form called beta-carotene and it as vitamin A as a lipid form. So I don't think that would be the answer. What I'd be concerned about, well, there's lots of things I'd be concerned about, but your wife's loss of vision, has that been looked at? Has she had a dilated exam and her retina be examined?
Well, she went to the eyesight had been bothering her for quite a while. I'd say at least 2 years, and it seemed to be getting a little worse. And so she did see an ophthalmologist, and she went in with the idea she wanted to get the LASIK procedure done.
Mm-hmm.
And so he did that, and that was in mid-December. It hasn't been getting, it's been sort of getting better. And, of course, he had her on a lot of eye drops because he was saying that her eyes were quite dry. And then eventually you have, I guess, two drains in each eye, and he plugged one.
Punctal plugs, yeah.
And then, well, put a plug in one and then actually stitched the other one.
Right.
In one eye. And now she seems to be, you know, quite moist in that eye and even, you know, crusting up.
How's your vision doing, though?
Well, she feels that it's getting a little bit better.
Okay. All right. So just to answer your question about vitamin A, it's low on my list of concerns, but you can certainly, you can check a serum level of vitamin A or have a, and just see what it is.
Well, that's been ordered, but she hasn't gone in for the test yet.
But yeah, vitamin deficiency would be low on my list. My major concern when someone has visual loss is their retina okay? Do they have swelling, particularly if they've got a major derangement in their physiology? And, you know, morphine pumps are wonderful. They are life-saving. They keep people from killing themselves. They're a good thing for chronic pain. Methadone is also a good drug, but it has major side effects, just like steroids. It's a heavy-duty drug. You use it when you have to. But you understand that if a person's taking it daily, they're going to have all sorts of physical changes as a result. And one of the constipation and leading to the subsequent surgery. But that's a really unusual complication. It makes me wonder that there may be something else going on at a more basic level. So I don't know if this is just a coincidence.
You mean the vision?
Yeah, pulling it all together, the weirdness in the colon and the weirdness in the eyes, and is there some underlying vulnerability, inflammatory disorder, autoimmune disorder? I'd certainly think that she should be worked up for autoimmune disease, you know, good rheumatology workup here, because this is just a little weird,
mm-hmm.
You know, the combination of symptoms smells rheumatologic or autoimmune. Maybe it's nothing, that's just an intuitive thing on my part, and I'm not a master diagnostician. Rheumatologists generally are, though, so it might be worth seeing a rheumatologist.
Rheumatologist.
Yeah, specialist in basically the joints, but also in autoimmune disease. And there are linkages between the spine, the colon, and the eyes, and the skin in general, and other joints. So
well, she had some arthritis in her hands. And,
the plot thickens. Yeah, I think she needs a rheumatologic workup. I hope you find something that could be treatable in a systemic way. It feels like the dominoes are falling. And how old is she?
48.
Oh, that's such a shame. She has my heart, and I just sincerely hope that her eyes do continue to improve. But do get that rheumatologic workup, and good luck to you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Let's go to Hap in Templeton. Hello, Hap. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning. I had Bell's palsy about 2 years ago, out of the blue. I'm 63 years old, and I had the twitching and everything, and it was diagnosed with Bell's palsy. My neighbor is also my doctor, and he says, that's what you've got.
Mm-hmm.
So it affected me for a few days.
Just a few
and
days?
And I'm pulling off right now because I'm
Thank
on
you
a cell
very
phone.
Much. Being a good cell phone citizen, that's what we
yes.
like.
And anyway, he gave me some antibiotics, and I guess I had a mild case. It bothered me for about, 8 to 10 days, but it went away. But ever since that time, it seems that if I'm yawning or just opening my mouth to put a hamburger in or something like that, I get cramps. And it starts in the back of my, my jaw and down my jawbone and sometimes, underneath. I don't know what the muscle group is under there. But, it sometimes lasts as much as 18, 20 seconds, and I feel like an idiot because it's not in your leg or anything like that, but it's in my jaw. And I wondered if it was possibly related because it's all happened since I had the Bell's palsy. And I don't see, one was viral, and this one has to do with the muscle, so it doesn't compute, but...
No, actually, it computes real well. I'll explain. But tell me, it's the same side, right? It's always, the cramp is always on the same side as the side of the Bell's palsy.
Actually, yes.
All right. I want you to do a little test for me. Take your hand and put it up just in front of your ear on the jaw joint, mm-hmm. on that side, and open and close your jaw slowly, and then tell me if you feel kind of a crunch or a drag or a click or a pop, some sort of... grab in the mechanism there.
Not really.
Okay. And you're able right now, you're not having the cramp, you can open your mouth fully, your teeth feel like
yes,
they fit together
just,
properly.
And it's just crazy. It's just mm-hmm. awkward times. And
right. All right.
Not every day, and it's not, it's a couple, maybe once a week, and then next week it's two times, and it's just...
I got it. A couple thoughts. First of all, Bell's palsy is the seventh cranial nerve, which controls the facial. That's right. Seventh cranial nerve controls the facial musculature, and so it's important for opening the eye. So your eye droops when you have Bell's palsy. It's important for closing and opening the mouth, so your mouth droops and you have trouble drinking, like from a straw is usually impossible. And some people with Bell's palsy, the nerve never comes back, and they're left with a permanent facial droop on that side. You'll see that occasionally. I believe that there was one newscaster, in fact, who developed Bell's palsy and basically had to quit their career. I don't remember who that was, but I...
Actually, my brother-in-law had that.
Yeah. So in terms of full recovery, my suspicion is that you didn't quite get full recovery. And that you've got just a little bit of residual damage in one of the branches of the seventh nerve that's influential in controlling that muscle. So instead of paralysis, you've got the opposite. You've got a spasm, a spasticity, in other words. When a stretch receptor is fired by rapid opening of the mouth, then the stretch receptor would go to the nerve root at the base of the brain and send a signal back, modulated signal back to the muscle telling it to relax during and then contract during chewing, and your signal is getting distorted probably because of damage to the nerve. So what do you do about this? One thing that might be helpful would be to do slow stretches and open and close your mouth several times widely before you start eating and just kind of rub the muscle maybe a little bit. But essentially, throw some modulating stimulus into the mix. Okay, muscle, we're going to stretch and contract multiple times now, and then start eating. And see if you can override this little spasticity thing that you're getting. Since it's only happening some of the time, I suspect that there's a good chance that with just a little bit of modification like that, you can make it go away until you forget, and then you'll get it, and then you'll go, oh, okay, that is working. It's probably permanent. It doesn't sound like serious pathology, but I do think it's probably related to your Bell's palsy.
Okay.
As long as it's not getting worse, I think you can sit tight with it. If it's becoming more and more frequent, probably time to go back to the neurologist. Sometimes if we put people on, believe it or not, a herpes drug for a long period of time, we could back this off. And another thing that you could try, and I'm always willing to recommend alternative therapies when acupuncture, when Western medicine doesn't have a good fix. This, like TMJ, would be something where acupuncture might be successful.
Oh, well, good.
So good luck
to you.
Well, as
I say, I will at least try the exercising and see if that brings anything. And if it gets, hopefully, knock on wood, if it gets worse, I'll try the acupuncture.
Very good.
You've satisfied me that it was related to the palsy. I figured it had to be, since the time frame, everything started with that. So
yeah,
that's at least helpful to know that's the cause.
Good luck to you.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. Ask Dr. Dawn is made possible by a grant from Well Within Spa. Well Within offers massage therapy, face and body care, and private spa rooms overlooking a Japanese garden in downtown Santa Cruz. Information is available at 458-WELL and online at wellwithinspa.com. We're going to go now to Andrew in Santa Cruz. Hello, Andrew. You're on the air.
Hello, Dr. Dawn.
Hello.
I'm calling about childhood immunizations.
Okay.
My wife and I just had a baby.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a little bit conflicted about what I hear about immunizations. And I know they're not all created equal. I know some are more important than others. And I wanted to get some feedback on that.
Okay. Well, let me start by saying that there are certain diseases, as you know, that are not going to disappear by herd immunity, and vaccines are not perfect. And let's start with the fact that you don't always get a good immune response, and sometimes even if you do get a good one initially, that immune response wears off over time. But the major purpose of these immunizations is to get a person through childhood, where most of these diseases are killer diseases, into adulthood, where they're going to get sick, but they won't die. And if you think in terms of that's the goal of immunizations, a lot of the criticism of immunizations disappears, because a lot of the criticism comes from, they aren't all that good anyway, and people still get sick. Just like now, we've got a mumps problem in the Midwest, in Ohio. I don't know if you've heard about it.
Yes, I did.
But there's like a little epidemic in college people, and college people have all had two MMR vaccines, because you don't get into college without that, or without a, you know, letter, because measles is such a problem. And So we give measles, mumps, rubella to kids twice. In fact, we used to just give it once, but then we had a measles outbreak in the mid-80s. We had this thing called atypical measles in college-aged kids who'd only gotten one vaccine. So we went, okay, we got to give two measles vaccines. And even having done that, we've now got mumps coming back. And so it is not a perfect science. That's a set. The ones I feel strong about, the way I rank them, is I take the approach, what will kill the baby? And I get very, very uptight taking care of babies who haven't had a tetanus vaccine.
Yes.
Okay. Tetanus, diphtheria, and pertussis are big killer diseases and used to kill lots of infants. Pertussis is a gnarly subject, because pertussis vaccine, particularly the old one, we have a new one now called acellular pertussis, which is better, but pertussis vaccine can sometimes cause antibodies that will inflame the brain and actually attack the brain. It's called encephalitis, and it not only can be fatal, it can cause brain damage.
So that is the vaccine itself?
That is the vaccine, or the immune, more accurately, it's the immune reaction to the vaccine.
Okay,
and
so
it doesn't happen very often. It's about 1 in 50,000 people who are vaccinated will suffer a vaccine-related event. 99% of those are prolonged fever and headache, and that's as bad as it gets. A very small percentage of that, one remaining percent, will end up with permanent brain damage. So you're looking at maybe 1 in a million children with brain damage as a result of a vaccine. Now, that bothered everybody. So Japan, courageously, although I don't think they thought of themselves as doing the experiment, they just stopped vaccinating children for pertussis. And the very first year, they lost something like 500 babies to pertussis, and they went, oh, I guess this is a bad idea. One kid with brain damage versus 500 dead kids is not a good trade-off. And pertussis is never going to go away. It lives in the throats and noses of people who are healthy. So it's not something we can really ever eliminate. And unfortunately, the immunity wears off. And so when you're 20 or 30, you can get pertussis. even if you were vaccinated. But you don't die from it. You cough and you annoy the doctor a lot because you cough for 2 months and you're very whiny. But you don't die.
So that is a vaccine that
I have my cutoff for kicking people out of my practices if they won't vaccinate their kid for tetanus. They're out because tetanus is in the soil.
Right.
It's always going to be there. Kids get into the dirt. They get dirt in their cuts. And I've seen people die of tetanus.
Yes.
And I will never voluntarily watch another person die of tetanus. It's worse than the electric chair. It's worse than anything you can imagine. It's a horrible death. So we don't go there in my practice. Pertussis, if you really insist that you want to subject your child to the risk of whooping cough, I will let you. I will make sure that there's plenty of disclosures in the chart so that you don't decide to sue me because I didn't really explain it to you afterwards when you've got the damaged baby. But nevertheless, I will tolerate that. Diphtheria, very nasty disease. We don't see it anymore because of the vaccination. But it's, again, if patients are going to decide to subject their child to risk of diphtheria, I will let them without booting them out of my practice. Measles. Kills babies, doesn't kill older kids. Bad disease if you get it in infancy. Mumps, maybe it causes sterility if you get it in infancy. That's actually being reconsidered. Usually doesn't kill you.
Yeah, I think that vaccine they give about 2 years.
MMR is given usually starting at about 15 months because it doesn't work. Measles, mumps, rubella vaccine doesn't work earlier than that.
Uh-huh.
All right, let's see. What else have we got? Measles, mumps, rubella causes birth defects. We like to immunize children against it so that when they're adults, they don't get pregnant and have a baby that's damaged. Rubella is German measles. It actually is not a lethal type disease in childhood. We've got hepatitis B. Do we now vaccinate everybody against hepatitis B? I kind of disagreed with this when it was implemented because it's a sexually transmitted disease. You're going to get it from shooting up, or you're going to get it from having sex with people who've been shooting up. Why are we vaccinating infants for a sexually transmitted disease? And the answer is because that's when we can get them into our clutches and vaccinate them. Whereas once they get to be 5, they can, they disappear from the system and you never have another shot. So it was a social policy decision. I don't think from a medical standpoint it's all that justifiable, and I don't insist that people get that vaccine in childhood. I just explained to the parents that, when they start to bud, so to speak, breasts and pubic hair might be the time to get them in and do that vaccine.
Okay.
All right, let's see. The other vaccines, the rotavirus is going
to... Hib.
That one you need. And that's because of the meningitis. When I was training before Hib vaccine, at least once a week I admitted a baby with life-threatening meningitis. It was almost always H influenza meningitis. Since we've started vaccinating, that has gone away, literally gone away. Prevnar, which is pneumococcal vaccine, they're a little bit vaccine happy, and it's a benefit, but I think it's kind of cost effectiveness wise a little bit of a boondoggle. I still do Prevnar in my practice because it's covered by the insurance companies. It's not a dangerous vaccine. It doesn't have major problems in terms of side effects. But if I were going to skip vaccines, I guess the ones that I would skip would be not the Hib, not the DPT, the diphtheria pertussis, because those are what will kill the patient vaccines. And then I'd push pretty hard on the MMR. They took thimerosal, which was the mercury-containing thing, out of MMR at least 3 years ago, probably longer. So I'm no longer, even if you think that it causes autism, which is pretty controversial, I'm no longer worried that I'm going to push that button with that vaccine. So a bit of a long discussion, but I hope that covers it for you.
Yeah, it definitely helps a lot. And I'm glad you told me. So the pneumococcal, that vaccine is a benefit, but it's not going to be life-threatening. So that's the
The pneumococcal is, if I'm going to skip, I'll probably get in trouble for this, but I prioritize diphtheria, pertussis, tetanus, Hib. These are the biggies. Those are the ones you don't want to skip. Hepatitis B could be put off until teen years. Prevnar is recommended. You reduce hospitalizations, you reduce pulmonary infections, pneumonia. the number of children who die of pneumonia because they didn't get Prevnar is very low.
Okay, and what about at what time in a baby's development for these?
Depends on the vaccine. You have to wait till the immune system is mature. And with things like the DPT, because people's immunity that they get from mom wears off in their third month of life, we try to get a vaccine in before the third month of life. So that it takes, you know, roughly 10 days to start making antibodies. And it takes probably a month to get your levels up to anything decent that's going to protect you.
Okay.
So if you figure, okay, mom's antibodies start to wear off once you are no longer hooked up to mom's circulation, mom's antibodies are pretty much too low a titer to help you by 3 months. If you vaccinate at 2 months, you've got a titer that's coming up, they cross, you're still protected. So I really like that 2 month deadline for the DPT and the HIP.
The immune system's old enough at 2 months?
Yes. Demonstrably old enough to respond.
Okay. And how about giving more than one at... I hear that maybe it's best to give one at a time, so if there's a reaction, you know, which vaccine they're going to get.
That's true. The problem... Now we're getting into a social policy issue. From a practical standpoint, a lot of people don't get their children vaccinated because they can't afford the copay, or they only come to the doctor once, or the kid seems fine. So we have a tendency to shotgun it when we have the children in our clutches. Mm-hmm. I have a different kind of practice. I have a lot of university-educated people who are very responsible and do better with their scheduling than I do. So I have no problem separating out the vaccines. I feel I can sort of assess whether I think this is a reliable family who will do a distributed vaccine schedule. And I think it's nicer for the child, and you're right, I can figure out if they're having a reaction, what they're having a reaction to. The only downside of it is that the kid gets conditioned to anticipate a shot whenever they come to the doctor's office, which means if the parents are wimpy, then we're going to have a problem when the kid is sick and they're just kicking up a hell of a ruckus because they don't want a shot. And they'll be five before they believe me that I'm not going to give them a shot if the first, you know, 2 years of their life, every time they come into the office, they get a shot.
My thought is to just the first series to give them separately, and then they can get them all at once, because that way you'll identify if there's a reaction.
I think that's eminently rational, and as long as you can talk your doctor into believing that you'll actually come back, I don't think you'll have a problem.
Okay.
Okay, good luck.
That is great. Thank you very much, Doctor.
You're welcome, and congratulations. You're listening to Ask Dr. Don, and just a couple of details. The weight loss drug that I talked about at the top of the show is not yet released by the FDA, although I think it's only a matter of time. It is called Rimonabant, Rimonabant, and the researcher who is the corresponding author for this is a fellow named Xavier P. Sounier. And I'm going to post on the website, askdrdon.com, the email to this person. So if you're interested in finding out if there is a clinical study near you that you might be able to qualify for to get this drug, which is still not released for purchase, but there's a lot of studies going on. So if you're a good guinea pig, you can get studied. So I'll put that up so that people can chase that a little bit. You could also just try putting that into a search engine, and you'd probably get a list of clinical trials. Let's go now to Gail in Salinas. Hello, Gail.
Should adults be vaccinated for hepatitis B?
Well, it kind of depends on what you're planning to do. I'm not worried anymore about you getting it from if you get in a car accident and you have to have a transfusion, getting hepatitis B. Not worried about that.
Mm-hmm.
Sexually, if you are in a long-term monogamous relationship and if that ever stopped, planned to use condoms and do venereal disease testing before you got involved with someone else, you're not going to pick it up sexually. You best know whether you're going to be involved in IV drug use. The only other thing about hepatitis B is that if it's very contagious in blood, so even a little dot of blood flecked into your eye would give you potentially hepatitis B.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, if you're a healthcare worker, or you're a school nurse, or you're likely to be exposed to somebody's nosebleed and have to clean it up,
mm-hmm.
then or you're in Fight Club. I mean, things.
I teach children.
Yeah, I'd probably get vaccinated because if somebody starts having a nosebleed, you're going to run over there and work on it. And, you know, chances are the kid will have gotten their Hep B vaccine in childhood. But then, of course, there's always the family that has, you know, for religious reasons or philosophical reasons, doesn't vaccinate the child. It's a series of long shots. Very safe vaccine. It is not active virus, so it's not going to give you hepatitis B. Not possible.
Okay.
So I think it's a good idea for people who work with the public.
Well, I called to ask you about methadone. Thank you for the answer on hepatitis B.
We've got enough time for that question. Go ahead.
Well, it's controlling my pain finally. I've been in horrible back pain for many, many years. And I've been on methadone now for about 3 or 4 months. And it's really doing it. I'm actually looking for a job again. I thought I was never going to be able to work again.
Well, so that's great news.
Horrible side effects.
Which are?
Well, constipation, and I don't feel comfortable driving. It affects my whole,
yeah.
I don't know, I feel like I've had a few margaritas or something.
Mm-hmm. So some of it's actually leaking into your brain.
Yeah. Is that?
Yeah, it's hitting some of the opiate receptors in your brain. That's what you're...
supposed to do that?
Well, it's not supposed to, but you must have a leaky blood-brain barrier.
Okay.
You've heard of leaky gut? Well, there's also leaky brain, and it doesn't mean you forget things. It means Yeah, it means things move from the bloodstream across the blood-brain barrier a little more effectively than they should. So some people have a leaky brain barrier, and it sounds like you're one of them. So with respect to the brain stuff, there's not much you can do.
Okay.
With respect to the constipation, that you might be able to actually prophylax fairly well by using stimulant laxatives like Cascara, or there's also one called Miralax, which is, it's like very close to propylene glycol, which is antifreeze. I know, it sounds really rad, but it's inert, goes into the gut, and helps move things forward. It's kind of slow acting, but those can be used long term.
What about Senna?
Senna can be used long-term. They used to say that you would become resistant to it and have problems, but that actually turns out to be fairly rare. And
I noticed that if I eat anything with maltitol in it,
With what?
You know, the sugar-free things, they sweeten them with maltitol?
Maltitol, okay. Well, right, that is causing an osmotic effect. So it's holding water in your intestines, not letting your large intestine absorb it. So that's great. If that works, that mannitol is a perfectly safe. In fact, we used to use that in newborn infants as the constipation cure of choice because it's so safe.
Good.
So that one works for you. You got your answer right there.
Okay.
You can do that forever.
I will.
You just have to get the dose right.
when you were talking to the gentleman whose wife has the back problems and methadone was mentioned, I got the impression that from you that there were other horrible side effects that maybe I should be aware of that I'm not.
On morphine? On
methadone?
No, the major side effects are the constipation and the CNS side effects, and it has, you know, its major problem is with the gut. So I don't think I don't see that lady's situation as fitting together as being a drug side effect directly. That's why I was worried about autoimmune disease. Because it wasn't computing for me otherwise.
So it's a relatively safe drug for me to take if it gives my quality of life a boost, huh?
Exactly. And you should just... I'm so happy that you found a solution for yourself. That's wonderful.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Thank you for calling.
Okay.
Bye-bye. So we have Leslie who wanted to call in with a short comment. Unfortunately, I don't think we're going to have time for that because we're really tight, but I hope that you'll call in next week. I didn't get a chance to do the book review to our other caller, but I promise that I will be getting to that soon. This is Ask Dr. Dawn, and we've been talking about all sorts of things, and we'll be doing that actually next week in a taped interview, and then I'll be back with lots of interesting information from the Institute for Functional Medicine. Coming up in a couple of weeks, we'll have an interview with a doctor who opened a medical marijuana clinic, so that should be very, very interesting. This is Dr. Dawn Motika saying so long and stay healthy.